welcome to Contact High. Today's episode is a Shabbat replay from our Friday night Shabbat service on April 12th, when Rabbi Stephen delivered a sermon on the story of Passover and the Haggadah. What does it mean to leave a seat for Elijah? What does it mean to envision a future free from bondage? Take it away, Rabbi.
So the learner Seder that I mentioned earlier has been a dream of mine for a while, to create a safe and supportive learning environment to experience the rituals of Passover with great food and good company, designed for those who are celebrating this holiday for the first or second time. 2 years ago, for our inaugural attempt, which I know a few of you in this room were there, my mom and I schlepped homemade chili, enough for 30 people, in the back of an Uber, and then flipped the Mishkan headquarters to accommodate our Intro to Judaism students and their loved ones. And last year, the event was staffed and catered. Thank you, Mishkan staff. And this year, we're moving into this space, a larger space, and expanding the Seder to include current students and alumni of the program, and really anyone who needs a spot at the table. We are also putting together our own Haggadah, stripping back the text to its essential elements to make sure that the holiday is accessible to everyone, no prior experience necessary. So as a result, I have been spending a lot of time with the Haggadah, the text that guides us through the Seder, so that at the very end of the evening, we can declare that everything has been done, kehilchato, kechol mishpato, vechukato, according to its laws, all of its statutes, and its customs. And I have to say, folks, Passover is a strange holiday. It truly is. It's a weird one. I can find analogs between the rest of our holidays and those celebrated in other religious communities. Lighting candles for Hanukkah, Diwali, dressing up in debauchery for Purim, Mardi Gras, fasting for Yom Kippur, Ramadan, only attending synagogue once a year for Rosh Hashanah, Easter. But sitting down for a meal that begins with parsley and salt water and ends with a mouthful of matzah, that includes raising a toast to and opening the door for the ghost of Elijah, that repeatedly punctuates the entire evening with the question, what in the world does all of this mean? The Passover Seder is our most observed, that's statistically true, and I would say most idiosyncratic tradition. And the point of all of this, and an answer to the question, what in the world does all of this mean, is to get us to tell the story of Passover, how our ancestors journeyed down to Egypt, became enslaved under an oppressive regime, toiled for 400 years, and then were miraculously liberated from bondage, leaving in such a hurry that they didn't even have time to let their bread dough rise. And not just remember the story, but to relive it. The historian Yosef Chaim Yerushalmi argued that the Seder is not intended to be a pantomime, but the collapsing of the past into the present. He writes, "Memory here is no longer recollection, which still preserves a sense of distance, but re-actualization. When we open the Haggadah and read, 'It is for this that God brought me out of Egypt,' we are supposed to mean it. We are asked to own this story because it is our story. But we are also asked to own this story because it is one that we have needed to hear in every single generation, including this one. For in the end, the Passover story is about the impossible becoming possible. It is a reminder that the world as it is now, as intractable as it might seem, does not need to be the world as it is tomorrow. The key is to believe. After all, there can be miracles if you believe. Not as an act of naivete, but a posture of resilience and of courage and of vision. There is a reason that leaders of other marginalized communities have drawn from our story to inspire movements for social change. The tale of an enslaved people becoming free, despite the many obstacles set against them, shows that there can be a path forward if you just have the audacity to see it, even if it's one that's never been walked before. Now, of course, the Haggadah presents a simplified version of this story. The Exodus version is a lot longer. We were enslaved. We cry out to God. Moses appears, burning bush, let my people go, 10 plagues, and boom, we are free. But the reality of this story was much messier. Moses had to work hard, not only to convince Pharaoh of his vision for a better future, but even the Israelites, the ones in slavery, the ones who yearned the most for change. When Moses initially meets with Pharaoh to demand our freedom, the latter responds by increasing our workload. Instead of giving us the straw needed to make bricks, we would now have to gather our own. Unable to produce the same amount of bricks in the same amount of time, our foremen are beaten. And they go to Pharaoh and they entreat him, but he refuses to change his conditions. And on their way back to the other Israelites to give them this bad news, they encounter Moses and his brother Aaron. Yireh Adonai alechem v'yishpot, they say, may God bear witness and punish you, for you've handed Pharaoh and his advisors the very sword by which they mean to kill us. During the Seder, we read about four children, one who's wise and one who's wicked, one who's simple and one who is silent. And I believe the four men in this case are the wicked children, because they're the ones who are asking the provocative questions that many of us are thinking, but perhaps too polite or too afraid to ask. See what you've done? They say, you've made things worse. What is all of this to you, Moses, protected by your status as a former prince of Egypt? You've never been a slave. What do you know? What makes you think that things are going to change? And these aren't bad questions. The Israelites have been slaves for 400 years. And in those 400 years, I think it's unlikely that Moses was the very first person to dream of freedom. Yet, still bearing the shackles of slavery, the foreman knew that dreams are not the same as the real world. So how could they listen to this wise child, this know-it-all who had the privilege of encountering the creator of all things, the literal creator of all things in a burning bush? There are other wise children in this story too, people who had the hope and the imagination to envision something bigger than the narrow view right in front of them. The midwives who saved Israelite children from Pharaoh's murderous edict. Yocheved, Moses' birth mother, who secreted him away with the dream that there was a better future for him. Bat Paro, Pharaoh's daughter, and Moses' adoptive mother, who saw a child in need, or others might have seen a stranger of no concern to them. And Miriam, a prophet in her own right, who alongside her brothers will help lead our people to freedom. No, all of these people are women, by the way. The wise children. And then there are the simple children, the ones who ask, what are you even talking about? Slavery is all I've known. Slavery is all my parents knew. Slavery is all my grandparents knew. The memory of freedom has faded into history. It is a myth as distant as it is unattainable. And then, of course, there's those who labor in silence, who are broken by loss, bent by hopelessness. There are bricks that still need to be made, and they just want to make it through one more day. Yet just as we're told that all four children are sitting at the Seder table, so too are each of these people part of the journey out of Egypt. For in the end, we leave together as an Erev Rav, our text says, a mixed multitude, the wicked and the wise and the simple and the silent, the hopeful and the disbelieving, the faithful and the naysayers, all ages, all gender expressions, all abilities, and also slaves from other tribes and Egyptians who had also been crushed under the heel of the same exploitative system, and perhaps even some of the privileged class who no longer wanted to participate in a society that treated human lives as disposable. And so I wonder if the Israelites saw the people who walked out of Egypt with them as strangers, or if they saw them as one of their own. But regardless, they walked together and at the foot of Mount Sinai become a single people of common cause and shared purpose. This year, as we gather around the table, we might find that a different four children are attending our Seder. Maybe it's a Zionist and an anti-Zionist, the one who just wants everyone to get along, and the one who doesn't want to talk about it because, for the love of God, it seems like it's the only thing rabbis give sermons about now, and even they're tired of it. It's the aunt who donates to AIPAC sitting next to the cousin who protests with If Not Now. It's the sibling who volunteers with the friends of the IDF breaking matzah with a friend who supports the American Friends of Combatants for Peace. Or maybe the ideological differences are smaller, but in their proximity are no less painful. With this to look forward to, coming together for Passover becomes a daunting proposition. It might be the fear of a knockdown, drag-out fight. Or maybe it's just wanting to avoid the awkward tension, a sense of disagreement or distance, even if it remains unspoken. So I want to give a shout out to Mishkanite Eliza Becker, right over there somewhere, I saw you, who wrote some very helpful tips on how to navigate these conversations or make the intentional choice to not have these conversations at the table. And you can find her article online. I highly recommend it. It's on our Passover resource page. But she outlines skills that I believe are not only essential for navigating our Sedarim, but moving forward through the months ahead. Entering dialogue with an open heart and mind. Showing respect and empathy for everyone. Demonstrating a spirit of curiosity, encouraging everyone at the table to participate so that we can hear each voice that is there, and perhaps most importantly, understanding how our story calls us toward every place where there is still sorrow and suffering in the world. But what I want to talk about now is why we're even sitting at the table in the first place. Why show up for this singularly strange dinner party, which this year in particular is shot through with anxiety? Or maybe more anxiety than usual. I sincerely believe, I really truly believe, that just like the Erev Rav, just like the mixed multitude of the Passover story, the people you sit with at the Seder, even with our sincerely held differences, have a shared vision. One of safety, one of peace, a future where all people are able to live with dignity and freedom. And I know this is true because I've spoken to a lot of you, to people who are like and unlike each of those four children. And our collective hope, which is a very Jewish hope, by the way, draws from the same source, the memory of an enslaved people becoming free. The journey from oppression to liberation, of the impossible becoming possible, the Passover story, our story. This is why we need to tell and retell it. It is for this that God brought me and you and all of us out of Egypt. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel writes, "Recollection is a holy act. We sanctify the present by remembering the past, in recalling how we walked alongside each other then, we become so much more capable of doing that now." So next Shabbat, the one preceding Passover, we read from the book of Malachi. "I will send the prophet Elijah to you before the day of God arrives, awesome and terrifying." And what will Elijah do in that moment, we ask? The text says, he will reconcile parents with children and children with their parents. More than a messianic hope for the end of times, the cup of wine and the open door that we offer Elijah is a reminder that repair is possible. And just as our recollection of the past is for all of us, our tradition's vision of the future includes each of us as well. The breakdown of relationships that we might be experiencing in this moment, whether at the Seder table or in our communities or on social media, is not irreparable, nor does it mean that we should give up on the project of coming together. In fact, difference and debate and distrust are part of the Passover story. See all that infighting between Moses and the Israelites. And so is the moment we emerge on the other side of the Reed Sea. The road behind us littered with pain and loss. It was there. It was there on the edge of the wilderness that we chose to set aside what was pulling us apart so that we had the capacity to hold one another, parent and child and neighbor and stranger, so that we could rest our heads on each other's shoulders and cry, so that unburdened we could dance, so we could open up our hearts and sing as one. So this year, I want you to leave space for Elijah at your Seder. Like, I want you to really lean into it. I want you to insist on using the biggest glass for his wine, maybe even the gaudiest glass, the ugliest glass, whatever stands out most on your table. And I want you to fill it to the brim. I want you, when you open the door for Elijah, to like fling it open as far as it can go. I want you to have a vision of a better future, because having a vision of a better future is the first step toward reaching it. When we believe in the impossible, it becomes possible. Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
And if I don't see you before Passover, Chag Pesach Sameach.
Shabbat Replay is a production of Mishkan Chicago. Our theme music was composed and performed by Kalman Strauss. You can always see where and when our next service will be on our calendar. There's a link in the show notes. And if you appreciated the program, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. I know you've heard it before, but it really does help. On behalf of Team Mishkan, thank you for listening.